Thanks for your flexibility. I didn't want us to miss those. I knew I saw more people over there before we got started today. Back in 2008 and 2009, I participated in a program called Leadership Greenville. It's put on by the Chamber, and the purpose is to develop informed and committed leadership for Greenville County. Throughout the year, experts from a variety of different areas engage the group on topics from quality of life to education, from human services to justice. I have many, many memories from the experience. One was my ride along with a City of Greenville police officer. We responded to a number of calls on our beat during the 5 or 6 hours I spent in the car with her. Almost every single one of them was for domestic violence. Another day, we took a poverty tour and participated in the poverty simulation at United Ministries. We saw just how complicated it is to actually access the services needed to make ends meet. I learned a lot that year, and I'm thankful to have had the experience. Perhaps the day that stuck with me most was the one on justice. We heard from experts, but to be honest, I can't remember who they were, what they said, or even how they defined justice. What I do remember was our small group site visit that afternoon. We loaded up into 2 cars bound for Simpsonville. After passing through several miles of farmland, we pulled into an unassuming group of buildings with a tiny little sign that read, Generations Group Home. It didn't feel like they wanted too many people to find them, truthfully. We walked inside a double-wide trailer that served as an office and sat down for a conversation with the founder, Kathleen Reynolds. She began to tell her story of how Generations came to be. It was actually born out of tragedy. As a teenager, Kathleen's sister was raped by another teen. Her sister struggled to put her life back together after this trauma, but she was unable to. She ended up dying in her 20s, and Kathleen lived to carry this pain and truth. Meanwhile, Kathleen was a psychiatric nurse, and over again, she saw that teens were being admitted into psychiatric care because there was nowhere else for them to go. Still troubled by the story from her own family, Kathleen bravely decided to start a group home where she could care for sexually aggressive teenage boys and try to end the cycle of violence. Initially, the program had space for 8 boys, but in the same year, they turned 42 more away. They expanded their capacity to 20, but the need was still greater than the space constraints. Witnessing the success of the program, the Department of Juvenile Justice soon reached out to them, to Kathleen and her crew, about expanding yet again. They've added a 3rd building and program since. Generations is the only group home in the state that serves sexually aggressive adolescent males. The adolescent and pre-adolescent boys ages 10 to 19 at Generations have all been adjudicated through the Department of Juvenile Justice for sexually aggressive behaviors. Within the DJJ as a whole, over 80% of youth in the juvenile justice system returned to prison within 3 years. And yet only 2% of Generations children ever end up in trouble with the law again. With recidivism being a key measure in the justice system, these are incredible numbers and results, 2%. How is this possible? What is it they actually do that results in this kind of healing? On my first visit to Generations in 2009, one little fact they told us during the tour of the facilities stuck out to me the most. They showed us all around the school and living areas, and eventually we stopped by one of the bedrooms where the boys sleep at night. Each room has 6 or 7 twin beds, and the boys are encouraged to personalize their space by picking out bedspreads and other things that make it their own. And then at the center of the room is a desk. Our guide told us an adult staff member is on duty and present in the room throughout the night to ensure the safety of each boy as he sleeps. She went on to tell us, "We learned early on that many of the boys had been traumatized themselves in their sleeping environments, and they were afraid something else would happen to them at night. To alleviate their fears and ensure their safety and rest, generations began the practice of having an adult on duty in the room each and every night." She continued, "No matter how big the boy may be, when he lays his head down at night, he is still a child." Fast forward 3 years, and I found myself sitting in a restorative justice class at Emory. As we explored definitions of justice, the roots of violence, and examples of this approach called restorative justice, I realized that was exactly what I had experienced at Generations Group Home. Throughout the semester, I kept thinking back to my 2009 visit, so much so that I decided to focus my final project on Generations and go back to understand more about the healing work they were doing. I set up a meeting with the program director at Generations to learn more, and I returned to discover that most of the treatment is focused on groups. The boys participate in over 20 groups every week. And during each one of them, the boys sit in a circle and hold one another accountable. And though a therapist is present, the groups are primarily peer-run. Groups cover all sorts of topics, but the ones that caught my attention were the process groups, where the adolescents talk about their offending behaviors. Over time, they move through 4 stages at all different paces. They start in the accountability stage, where the individual takes responsibility for his offense. The cycle stage is next, and during that phase, that's where the group examines how their thoughts and feelings led up to their behaviors. The third stage is to consider victim impact, where they take a broad definition of victim and consider the families and communities, as well as the individual victims that were affected. Finally, the fourth stage is relapse prevention. As I learned more about what they were doing at Generations, I realized that in many ways their work was profoundly simple and profoundly restorative. So what is restorative justice? Kathy gave us a great glimpse this morning during the story. There are many examples of it. Generations happens to be one from our own community. Essentially, it's a philosophical framework and set of practices that proposes an alternative to the current way of thinking about crime and criminal justice. Restorative justice emphasizes the way in which crime harms relationships in the context of the community. It's the victim and the community that's violated, not the state. Restorative justice prioritizes accountability, taking responsibility for actions and taking action to repair the harm that is caused. The shift is from justice as getting even to justice as getting well. Perhaps one of the most well-known examples of a large-scale restorative justice project was the Truth and Reconciliation Commission that took place in South Africa. So why is it important to talk about restorative justice in this example today? Well, at least one reason is because our criminal justice system is not built this way. It's built on a retributive model that's deeply focused on punishment, perhaps the most disturbing of which is the death penalty. Currently, the United States is the number one incarcerator in the world, in the history of the world. While the U.S. only has 5% of the world's population, we have 25% of the world's prisoners. We talked earlier this year about Michelle Alexander's book entitled The New Jim Crow, which demonstrates how the war on drugs has reinstated a caste system where black men in particular have been targeted aggressively. African Americans make up only 12% of the overall population, 12% or less of the illicit drug users, yet black males make up over 65% of the incarcerated male population. The war on drugs is really just the latest example of gross racial injustice in our retributive model. In many ways, the modern death penalty is merely a substitute for lynching. Lynchings took the form of hangings, shootings, beatings, and other acts of murder. They became public spectacles in the South, and they were getting noticed and out of control with crowds cheering on these public murders. People in the North were taking notice and wanted to send in the federal government. Rather than letting this happen, lynchings were moved indoors in the form of executions. This past week, I've been reading Bryan Stevenson's book, Just Mercy. I commend it to you with a warning that though it's beautifully written, it's a difficult read. Stevenson is a Harvard Law alum who founded the Equal Justice Initiative in Alabama, a legal practice dedicated to defending the poor, the wrongly condemned, and those trapped in the farthest reaches of our criminal justice system. Story after story, case after case, Stevenson tells about the injustice of the criminal justice system. The central story in the book is about an African-American man named Walter McMillan. He's falsely tried, convicted, and sentenced to death row for a murder he did not commit. Supposed eyewitnesses were coerced to testify against McMillan, even though he had a number of alibis who confirmed that he was at his house hosting a barbecue when the murder took place. McMillan was a target because he had had an affair with a white woman in Monroeville, Alabama, where the state's ban on interracial marriage continued until the year 2000. Stevenson takes on McMillan's case shortly after his conviction, but even so, it takes him 6 years to get through the appeals process and prove that McMillan did not commit the crime. When Walter is interviewed several years later by a film crew, he says, "They put me on death row for 6 years. They threatened me for 6 years. They tortured me with a promise of execution for 6 years. I lost my job. I lost my wife. I lost my reputation. I lost my dignity. I lost everything." Walter's story isn't the only distressing one in the book. I read about 13 and 14-year-old children tried as adults and sentenced to life in prison, about women whose pregnancies went wrong and they found themselves in jail for life, about black people convicted again and again by all-white juries. With more than 25 years representing people who have been wrongfully or unjustly convicted, Bryan Stevenson had this to say: "Each of us is more than the worst thing we've ever done. My work with the poor and the incarcerated has persuaded me that the opposite of poverty is not wealth. The opposite of poverty is justice. The true measure of our character as a society is how we treat the poor, the disfavored, the accused, the incarcerated, and the condemned." Obviously, there's much work being done and much more work to do. I was relieved to hear the good news this week coming out of the Department of Justice that they will end the use of private prisons. This is an important step. This is an important step in the right direction after decades of rapid growth in the prison industrial complex. Between 1990 and 2005, a new prison opened in the United States every 10 days. The growing number of restorative justice projects and practices is also good news. Victim-offender reconciliation programs, peacemaking or sentencing circles, alternative dispute resolution and alternative sentencing, reentry programs, and truth and reconciliation commissions are all examples of restorative justice in action. In 2013, the New York Times Magazine published an extensive piece on the use of restorative justice in a particular murder case. The article is entitled, "Can Forgiveness Play a Role in Criminal Justice?" If you read the piece, you'll see that restorative justice isn't easier than retributive justice. In many ways, it's probably harder. A key part of the process is a restorative community conference where the offender, victim, facilitator, and law enforcement all come together to talk about the crime and its effects. And participants come to consensus about how to repair the harm. This, in and of itself, can be excruciating. And it's a vitally important part of the healing. So often, little to nothing is done to help people victimized by crime get their questions answered or have the harm done to them repaired. Restorative justice actually focuses on the victim more than the current retributive system, where the state is seen as the victim of the crime. Towards the end of Brian Stevenson's book, he has this to say about punishment. Simply punishing the broken, walking away from them or hiding them from sight, only ensures that they remain broken and we do too. There is no wholeness outside of our reciprocal humanity. In other words, our humanity is tied up together. How we see human beings and who we deem as human matters. How we deal with offenses and harms and mistakes matters. It would be easier to hold on to simple answers and worldviews that say some people are good and some people are bad and sort people into two categories. The problem is that when we've done this in the past, we've gotten it wrong, and we risk getting it wrong again. Restorative justice is hard work. Talking about our problems and our history, talking about the mistakes we've made, talking about how we've offended Black people in this country in particular and continue to offend them disproportionately through the criminal justice system is difficult but desperately needed work. Repairing harms, breaking cycles of violence, and restoring community. This work is not for the faint of heart. And yet I'm thankful and encouraged and challenged by the people giving themselves to restorative justice. I'm thankful to have had the chance to witness the good work at Generations Group Home with my own eyes, and I continue to be astounded by the choice that Kathleen Reynolds made to open up Group Home and break the cycle of violence. I think at least one of the reasons she did is because she saw the humanity of the children who were offenders, who themselves had been victimized and traumatized, who desperately needed help to turn their lives in a different direction. May we have the eyes to see the humanity of all people. May we recognize that we are all tied up in this web of life together. May we plant seeds of restoration and healing so that justice might roll down like water and righteousness like a mighty stream.